It is my distinct pleasure today to be at APHA and talk about elder mistreatment, which in fact fits very well with public health. Long ago, I thank Mary for saying I'm a rock star, but truthfully, I'm afraid that wouldn't be very accurate. Long ago, when I was a roadie, which I still am, to carry that analogy, I was invited to a group early on in Washington that tried to decide sort of what would be the great prongs we would have about elder abuse. How would we associate elder abuse? What was it? And I can tell you that was like, it had to be 10 years ago, if not more. And one of the things that it talked about, one of the top three of that particular piece was to make elder abuse, elder mistreatment — we weren't even talking about elder justice at that point, although we would talk about social justice — but it was to make elder abuse or mistreatment a public health issue. And it fits, I would argue very strongly that it fits beautifully. If child mistreatment and partner violence fit in a public health model, so does this. The issue is you are dealing with the issue of aging. And I think that's what makes this more complicated. Anyway, there I am, and there's what you see under all those titles is a woman who says yes far too much. And so that's enough said for me. And I don't have any relationships to disclose that I want you to know about. So, all right. And then I always start with a quote, because like Mary, I have a liberal arts background there in the past, and I can't stop myself. So there you go. And isn't his son now working in this very issue? So they're really cool. I am going to talk about two documents that were some most interesting scholarship I think I've ever done, actually, out of the box for me. But it was done in collaboration with the MetLife Mature Market Institute. We did publish on elder financial abuse. We call it FAB. But I'm going to talk about it framed within public health. So I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge all these wonderful folks who worked on this project. And Karen, of course, is one of my very best friends on the entire earth. So I just thought I would say that. She should be sad. Now, what makes this suitable for public health, and how does that fit? Anybody who's a student of public health at my freshman class, which would thankfully they're so excited they won't be meeting tomorrow. That would be 170 of them. My 170 intro to public health students all know this model, or they should. They've certainly been tested on it. And what they would know is this would be reminiscent, if you would, of Bronfenbrenner's socio-ecological model. And to be honest, I ground a good deal of my work in this now, and I didn't before. But it's the level of the individual, the level of the family, in this fund, level of the individual, level of the family, relational, community, peers, and societal cultural issues. And that's really a fine — there are other theories you could use about elder mistreatment, nicely positioned perhaps within the aging work, would be exchange theory, some power theories and control theories, self-efficacy theories. These could be some of the things that you could use to address elder mistreatment, probably financial exploitation. But this is the nicest model for public health to use. And it really gets at why this issue has failed, I think, to get enough traction in public health, and should. Mary is right to deputize you, because we need you all so badly. So elder abuse generally, Mary talked about that. I won't go much farther into that except to say, within the pieces and nuances that we know, we've learned more and more about this issue. And I think public health is well positioned to think about primary, secondary, and tertiary pieces of this, although I'm pretty interested in primary prevention here. And I really want to talk about exploitation, which is the oddest of the fifths, to tell you the truth, which is why I picked it. Not only that, because I've done some work on that fairly recently and want to think about it. But elder abuse is any number of things when you think about it. You can call it mistreatment. You can talk. We would take out self-neglect if we did, but that's really a nuance to discuss for today, bringing you up to speed. So abuse would be the things that you know. Somebody could come over and hit you with a pot or an iron or burn you with a cigarette. Neglect, commission, acts of omission and commission. Exploitation, exactly what it says, and I'll define that for you, and self-neglect, which falls uncomfortably in mistreatment, according to Richard Bonney being here doing some mental health work today, and self-neglect, where we sort of deal with individual rights to live as one pleases up against the right of the state and the parents' patriae doctrine for self-neglect, to protect. But so I'd work in that area, but right now we're going to talk about elder financial abuse. So elder financial abuse, when a person who stands in any position of trust to an elder or dependent adult takes or appropriates that person's money or property to any wrongful use or with the intention to defraud. So taking somebody's money, and I think this comes right out of the Elder Mistreatment Bible that we all know and love now so well. Prevalence of financial abuse. The good news is we know a little. The bad news is we don't know a lot. But financial abuse is the third most commonly substantiated type of elder abuse. If you ask my cop friend Randy Thomas, who wrote me this morning, another dear friend, he would say it's the thing he sees the most. The justice community would say it's the thing they hang their hat on because they can quantify dollar amounts, broken hearts, fractured relationships, even the bruising patterns that Laura has done so much work on are less evidentiary information than is a dollar figure somebody can try to recover. And it is, in the court system, in the elder justice system, the remedy that is most easily found for this kind of abuse. So if it's a tort, if it's a crime, it's one of the remedies. Sadly enough, it doesn't happen too much. For every known case of elder financial abuse, four to five cases go unreported. But to tell you the truth, we really have those numbers bounce around all over the place. Now, Dr. Hall allowed me to have his password, which I would like to give out now to you. Okay, and there it was. I was loud. But I want to tell you that the estimates of financial abuse vary. Colleagues in New York, Mark Lax being one of those, Art Mason being another, did a study that Mary referred to already, but found, and this was jaw-dropping because we were in the midst of this, not doing a prevalence study, but something else, to find that financial abuse was the highest type of elder mistreatment they found with a rate of 41 per thousand. 41 per thousand. We nearly died. We were just shocked by that particular piece. So the National Elder Abuse Incident Study conducted by the National Center on Elder Abuse, an earlier iteration of that, found that elder financial abuse constituted 30% of about 71,000 cases. So those numbers tend to move around a good deal. The question then, as we would start looking at what the individual does, is why? So let's think about that for a minute, about old people. Okay, so I put my gerontologist hat on. And so when we're thinking about the model, of the ecological model, let's think about older abuse as individuals and what they represent. Well, what they represent is the largest bolus of accumulated wealth in the country. Now, I was walking around on Market Street, and I was walking around getting here from the hotel, and of course, I saw things. I saw something very important to me. That would be Target in a big box store, which I had never seen. See, if I want to go get something, I want to go where it is. So if I want to go get money, I want to go where the money is. If I'm a thief or a criminal, I'm going to go to the source. So older adults would represent there a nice place for accumulated wealth. If I want to get money as an individual, I would go to my family member to try to get that money. And if you, Mr. Hall, won't give it to me because I want it and I need it, but I have a drug addiction, I'm going to ramp up the efforts to get it. And that may change exactly how I manage that. It may go from my asking you to my telling you, to my making you, to my killing you. So older adults can often be home alone. Many older adults are socially isolated, although scholars are bouncing on this one as a risk factor for elder abuse. So, as Mary said very astutely, who does the bulk of the abusing? Who is it?
Caregivers,
but family members. Okay, all right. And then if elders are socially isolated, that is another risk factor for being abused. So take your pick, I think, if you want to see how, as you think about that. And then older adults have some need for assistance. So this could be the case of what people have, but older people have at least 70% of the net worth of nation's households, and they get benefits that other people do not necessarily have. All right, and then we talked about the caregiving issues. All right, so risk factors continued. Females are victimized nearly 2 to 1, and it is not necessarily. I can remember being at other talks where people have asked me, like, well, why so many more women than men? if you're a gerontologist, you're very aware that the older adult population becomes more women than men, knowing that you males, women, live at least right now 7 years longer than men do. So when you're talking about issues of mistreatment on the other end of the life course, you're talking a lot about issues that pertain to women. So people are most vulnerable at their older adult years, particularly 80 to 85. And again, you would know that the 85 plus group is the fastest growing population group among older adults. We've talked about living alone again, and sometimes personality. Valuing dependence or being tenuous begins to create a risk factor for that. If you value independence, you won't necessarily tell anybody. You won't necessarily ask for help. If you are more tenuous, this may make you a person who may seem to be a person who might be victimized. Mary talked about this as well. We're still in the domain of the individual. But if you know about older adults, we know about certain things. Normal aging includes some cognitive decline. The news I need to tell you is biological studies will tell you this happens about the age of 30 and continues on until your demise. Most of us who can remember our names will know that we can actually do some things to enhance that memory. And also, I can tell you that most of us will not experience too much problem with the memory that we need to have throughout our life. It's the retrieval issues that will change. A friend of mine last night, I was saying, I thought you liked restoration comedies. He goes, no, it's French farces. I went, no, I know distinctly restoration comedies are what you like. And he goes, name one. I went, ah. Oh. I have a master's degree in a theater, and I thought, I can't do that. I'm sure that when I was 24 getting my master's, I could have done that very easily. But thank goodness I had all these electronic devices at my use, and I came up with William Wycherley, William Farquhar, and Congreve, and I was set again, and I remembered their names. But the retrieval took me longer, and thank God for my iPhone. All right, so normal aging continues. Dementia prevalence climbs for us and doubles every 5 years of age, and 50% of the population 80 plus has some form of medically diagnosed cognitive impairment. Just a little bit more biology, because public health does take that issue and marries that with the medical community in some ways and clinical function. It is executive reasoning that is the first of the types of reasoning brain functions to decline at some point. And what you look at when you see the issue here is this has a lot to do with exploitation and financial abuse and problem solving. So colleagues, particularly Dan Marzen down in, I think, Georgia, has done a lot of work with financial capacity. This would be how can an just as much we would talk about other kinds of capacity, this is one to independently manage one's financial affairs. And here would be an issue and a reason why we might begin to see more exploitation for older adults and how to help individuals in that way. Hang on just a minute. Okay, let's see, let me go to the next one. Decline of financial capacity occurs earlier than other forms of capacity, and older adults and family members may be unaware of that. I know with my own father, who worked in a bank most of his adult life, he began to make mistakes in his checkbook that I couldn't imagine that he was making. In fact, at one point, he actually asked me, would I think about balancing his checkbook for him? He just couldn't find the error. I found that so unusual. And yet, in fact, I couldn't find the error either. I couldn't make heads or tails of what he had done. We had to actually just, like, close the account and start over again. It was that difficult to deal with. But here was a person who had been managing finances all his life, and here was an issue that had come up for him. What's the work that we try to do on this particular issue of financial exploitation at the level of individual, and then moving on up to sort of bring it back to the ecological model? So the first time we did the MetLife 2008 study called Broken Trust, and I have to tell you, as an academic, it's really different for me to come up with these snazzy, catchy titles of things. We usually just put a colon in there and start with the front and look at the back and try to make it look like something. But yet, so it was really quite a journey in doing this work, because we just had our minds stretched in that way, and that's just okay, but it was different for me. I actually ended up enjoying that a great deal. But it was a comprehensive study looking at elder financial abuse. The things we were most comfortable with, as Dr. Hall and other academics in the room would know, we just like glommed onto that lit review. We did a lit review of everything we could think of for 10 years that had ever been done about that. And I couldn't imagine why the whole population of the United States wouldn't be fascinated by that. But that's not really what occurred. I thought that was the most fascinating thing that there was. But actually, that's not what it was. In fact, I guess I would be more banal, but I hope you won't be offended. In fact, what became the most interesting piece of this was a complete, and I will use this term, don't think about this more than 1 second, shower thought. I was thinking one day in the shower, as I'm sure people do, what could we do to use some of the data from the Administration on Aging that we had, but sort of had gone unneglected, and it's the things you published, Mary, it's the news feeds. What could we do with that? Because sort of, I know a discussion we had had was, we don't do much with that. Well, so no great shakes, really. I would call it a blinding flash of the obvious. But I thought maybe what we ought to do is do a sort of a word search and see how many times in the news feeds, which were coming out weekly, that we saw elder financial abuse. So we set out a template, we looked at a time period and looked at this, and then we began to do something pretty amazing, and that was we actually found a number of articles that were on elder financial abuse. There were other things, but these were articles that were appearing all around the country. We weren't looking internationally at that time, just to see what we were seeing in the press. And we coded for these particular pieces here. What was odd about it was when we would start talking about our literature review on this topic, everybody was quiet, but they were really interested in what was happening. It was like the game last night, but not quite, but sort of. What in the world were we finding from the news feeds? And so we, in fact, published off that, and because so many of those articles gave us a dollar figure that had to do with financial elder abuse, we began to calculate a number for that. And so we came up with $2.6 billion that had been lost. No one had done that before. Easily conservative, because certainly that's not all of it. But it got quoted wildly and everywhere, and I think then began to raise more the visibility of this issue. Then, because it had been so successful of raising the issue, they asked us to do another one. We said yes. So we did a follow-up study in 2000 that was published in 2011. We added more to our scholarly analysis. We reviewed articles from spring and the holidays. We added a little bit onto that. And then the piece, I think, where I'm intellectually most interested now is, first, let's be honest about elder mistreatment. Mary's totally correct. We are a long way off with that issue that, as opposed to child abuse or intimate partner violence. And so it is not a surprise, yet it is surprising because no one has much done it, to start thinking about what happens post-abuse. So I'm very interested in trying to understand, well, okay, so did you finally get it identified? Did it go through the justice system or not? Okay. But my issue is, what happens to people once that has been identified and it comes to the attention of somebody? So we were trying to follow up from the news feeds to locate individuals to see exactly what had happened to their lives after that had happened. Many die, but many don't. All right, so here were key findings from what we did in the MetLife study. The annual loss of $2.9 billion, or a 12% increase from 2008. For those of you looking at the macro level issue, what you're seeing here is we did our data collection at the beginning of a recession and at the end of some piece of it. Average loss to victims are the numbers here that you see. There are more family, friends, and neighbors who are doing the exploiting, but you can imagine that industry or Medicare and Medicaid fraud are the higher number of dollars because it's healthcare dollars, and that's where the money is. Who are the victims? So moving up just a little bit, women were twice as likely as men. You can look at their age breakdown here and a comparison of that. So you begin to see more women than men as exploiters, although this may have something to do with who reports at all. And again, 80 to 89 years of age living at home and needing assistance, which is what we talked about before. Perpetrators tended to be slightly more male. This has been consistent with lots of studies that have been done. You can see the average ages here, more female perpetrators between the ages of 30 and 49. They come from everywhere if one's a perpetrator. Becky, I'm blanking on her name, a law professor at Stetson University Law School, Morgan, is a retrieval issue. Becky Morgan and I were talking that everybody's an exploiter and everybody's a perpetrator and everybody's a victim. No group is outside the purview of being a perpetrator when it comes to financial exploitation. So we can go all the way from family, friends, caregivers, institutional caregivers, to just some stranger and a crime of just that is haphazard and unfortunate with people. So you can begin to see the numbers of those articles and issues of perpetrators there. And these were when we could find out who they were. So family and friends were 34% of the cases in the feeds most likely to exploit. You look at the list of that. Dr. Hall, I draw your attention to bullet number 4 and a later discussion, but we were finding it everywhere. And then some examples. Then community peers, higher dollar amounts, smaller percentage, but here were some of the things, false billing being one I know that you would have heard about before, and one I think that's going to be growing are the last two bullets, internet scams and identity theft, and we'll be tromping off in that direction pretty soon because I think that takes the next cake. I don't know about you, but if I didn't shop by internet, I probably wouldn't be dressed. So, all right, so community peers and strangers, that was higher and of interest to us, although I can't exactly tell you what I think that means. That is more occasion than anything else, and here are some examples of that. Common traits, they're persuasive, they're charming, they want a decision, and many don't ever leave the side of an elder. Undue influence, a good colleague of Mary's and mine, Lisa Nirenberg has done a tremendous amount of work in undue influence, but here is a way that perhaps people are financially abused, and you will notice the older gentleman and the young woman. It isn't that that cannot happen, it's just when sometimes in those instances there's something more going on than we think. Elder financial abuse can be a catalyst for other forms of abuse, which ratchets the whole ball game up into physical abuse and neglect, and in tandem with other things. Who's responsible for this? Well, we are. So at the level of community and peers, it's family members and caregivers, policymakers, the older adults themselves, who I think can really move mountains if older adults will take this issue on themselves. Health and financial professionals are the gatekeepers for this. And public health, I put here for community programs. We have a wonderful role to be found, particularly in prevention mechanisms. There's the Elder Justice Act that Mary talked about. At the level of society and change, this python of older adults is just moving through. It's just moving through. So that big is moving through, and it prevents a marvelous amount of a growing population, huge societal change, increase in technological possibilities, and an increasing opportunity for elder financial abuse. Okay.
All right.